Good morning, Your Honors. Jay Moffitt from Morris Nichols Arch and Tunnel on behalf of defendants appellees. With me at council table is Chad Elliter from Iowa and Manila. He will be making the argument on behalf of the appellee.
Defendants. Welcome to the court.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. I rise this morning simply to introduce my partner, member of the New York Bar, Morag Reynolds, who will be making the argument on behalf of the appellant, Jack Specific, Inc.
Good morning. Welcome to the court. When I turn the clock on, you'll see that you have 20 minutes of time and you'll have a green light. And I know that you've reserved 6 minutes. A yellow light will come on at the six-minute mark, and you can continue, but you will be using the time you've reserved.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Morag Reynolds on behalf of Appellant Jax Pacific, Inc. Jax is a 50% member of a two-member joint venture in the form of a Delaware LLC that was created to exploit a license to make and sell WWE wrestling video games. This appeal arises out of the lower court's complete denial of Jack's demand to inspect the books and records of the joint venture based on the trial court's conclusion that Jack's did not prove any proper purpose for such an inspection under Section 18305 of the Delaware Limited Liability Corporation Act. We respectfully submit, Your Honors, that if ever there were a books and records decision that warranted reversal, this is it, because Jax proved at least three separate proper purposes, any one of which was more than sufficient to warrant its inspection. First, Jax established a proper purpose to inspect the joint venture's books and records to participate knowledgeably in contractually mandated negotiations on the upcoming preferred return for the next distribution period under the party's joint venture agreement, a term which is coterminous with an automatic 5-year renewal term of the underlying license.
Could I stop you right there? Because I thought that determination had already been made.
Your Honor, the determination to renew the license?
No, the return.
Your Honor, the preferred return, which is Jack's profit distribution
right.
under the venture, is set periodically during each what's called a distribution period. The preferred return for the last distribution period, which commenced in 2006 and ends in December 2009, has been set, although that is outside the record. The arbitrator has ruled, and that has now been determined, although the books and records request that we made was initiated while those proceedings were pending. There is the next distribution period that in the agreement is known as the subsequent distribution period that commences on January 1, 2010. For which Jack's preferred return will need to be established under the agreement 180 days before the commencement of that distribution period. That means that the parties were required to commence negotiations by July of 2009 for this upcoming distribution period. And it was with that in mind that Jack's had also sought the records. However, the court below denied those based on its speculation that the license would not be renewed and that renewal period would not occur, so there would be no subsequent distribution period.
Well, the conclusion of the Vice Chancellor that your client did not have a proper purpose for seeking inspection was based on certain findings, subsidiary findings of fact, correct?
Some of the conclusions
correct.
Were. In fact, the first two conclusions were actually...
I'm just asking you whether they were based on subsidiary findings of fact.
There are some, yes.
And you challenge this on appeal?
We do.
If we were to find that there was no factual error here, would your position, would you be here?
I would, because you would have to reach the anterior question of whether the court applied the proper legal standard to assess whether or not we had demonstrated a proper purpose. And on all three of our purposes, we submit that the court applied an improper legal standard that this court reviews de novo. Just quickly, our three purposes are...
Well, what's the improper? I'm asking basically what the error of law is, apart from any claimed error of fact?
Yes. First, with respect to the first purpose, which is to engage in the future negotiations for the preferred return, the legal error that the court committed was to engage in speculation about the outcome of future proceedings future events to negate a proper present statutory purpose. Under very established Delaware Chancery Court precedent, which includes the Holtzman case, which we cited, Holtzman versus Groin, Kerkorian versus Western Airlines, and Kana versus Covad Communications.
Well, aren't we speculating either way? That is, you know, for you to prevail, for your client to prevail, we have to speculate that there will be a renewal of this joint venture agreement, yet you're checking the vice chancellor to test for speculating that there may not be, or at least it's very iffy as to whether there will be.
And then drawing
an inference from that.
To the contrary, Your Honor, respectfully, we are not requiring any speculation to enforce Jack's contractually mandated right now to engage in the negotiations that are necessary for the upcoming renewal term.
But there is no right now unless there is going to be a renewal of the agreement. And there hasn't been a renewal of the agreement by either side.
Well, the logic of the joint venture, in fact, Your Honor, the logic of the agreement requires that the parties engage in these negotiations in advance of the renewal term. And it's precisely so that they know.
But not necessarily in advance of a renewal.
Actually, in advance both of the renewal term and of a renewal, the contract is unequivocal that the parties are required to commence these negotiations 180 days before the end of the current term. That is in July of 2009. That is undisputed. The renewal term, the notice for the renewal term does not even need to be served until 60 days before the end of the current term. So by definition, the parties have to have already commenced negotiations in order to comply with the joint venture agreement. Its mandate that they establish a preferred return 180 days in advance of the next term. There is nothing in this agreement that says that the parties can await the renewal to commence those negotiations, or that the obligation to set that preferred return is contingent on that renewal being exercised, or on awaiting
the waiting services. Really, is it not to suggest your client has a present right to documents that would aid it in negotiating, its interest in a contract which even your client and the other party, the other joint venture, have not indicated that they wish to renew?
As a matter of law, the contract itself is unequivocal that the default position of this agreement is that it will renew. And here's why. First, under the terms of the WW video game license, that renewal is automatic. The condition is that there be no material default and that other guarantees have been met. There's no dispute that the guarantees were met. The only question was whether or not there was a material default. WWE, to this day, has not been able to establish a material default, and it would be extremely dangerous for courts to be speculating about the possibility that a counterparty to a contract of a Delaware company could possibly prevail in future lawsuits as a basis to deny a present statutory right of a 50% member of that joint venture to review the books and records to make a decision now that needs to be made about renewal. The decision is twofold. It's a decision.
Well, by calling it a present statutory right, you put the rabbit in the hat, don't you? I mean, the issue is whether it is a present statutory right. And for it to be a statutory right with any meaning, the court has to make certain factual findings about the bona fides of your client's purposes, as well as the essentiality of the documents that you're seeking to inspect, in relation to that purpose.
That's correct, Justice Jacobs. But in this case, there's never been any suggestion that that the purposes that were articulated by JAX Pacific were not bona fide. JAX is a 50% member of this joint venture, had sought to review the books and records, as I said, for three purposes: the upcoming preferred return negotiations, two, to value its interest as a 50% member, which includes a panoply of management rights, including the decision whether or not to renew.
Well, the Vice Chancellor, as I understand it, held that while in the abstract your client's purpose was bona fide, that it wasn't bona fide, it didn't have any bona fide relationship to the interest that your client had at the time these events were transpiring.
Well, if that reading could be given to it, then it's only because the Vice Chancellor accorded an unduly narrow definition to the type of interest that JAX Pacific had as a 50% member of this joint venture. Effectively, the Vice Chancellor adopted THQ's assertion that the JAX interest was confined solely to its interest in the preferred return, disregarding entirely the fact now conceded by THQ that every significant management decision to be made by this joint venture requires the votes of both members.
Okay,
and that
so
includes the decision to renew the license.
Is it fair to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that with respect to your client's first purpose, the error of law that you're contending was made here was that the court engaged in speculation? That is, concluded speculatively that there was no assurance at all that there would be a renewal, whereas as a matter of law, the court had to find that there would, that was the default position, that it would be automatically a renewal?
Yes, under this agreement, and clearly this agreement requires that both parties unanimously agree to waive a provision for the benefit of the joint venture. By definition, the opportunity to renew this extremely lucrative license for an additional 5 years after its 10-year term is a provision for the benefit of the joint venture. So the default position was that the parties would agree to renew it. The only evidence in the record was JAX Pacific had indicated it had every intention of renewing it. THQ had not put any evidence into the record whether or not it would also seek to renew it. So the court's conclusion that the renewal itself was speculative was not supported by the record and was not the product of a logical or orderly deductive process, and as a factual matter wouldn't be entitled to deference, but as a legal matter, reviewing the contract was erroneous as well. The second purpose really dovetails with the initial purpose of JAX, which is JAX need to the books and records of this joint venture as a 50% member of that joint venture. And in that respect, Justice Jacobs' decision on the Chancery Court in the Cordham case is on all fours here. In that case, there was a 50% non-operating member who also, like JAX, sought access to the books and records of the venture to value its interest, and the operating member, here like THQ, who controlled the records, denied that access. The court held that in such a circumstance, it is all important that this is a 50% owner of the venture, not just a shareholder who owns, say, 100 shares of a publicly traded corporation. And based on that key distinction between many of these, between this case and many other books and records case, the court offered, and it is appropriate, I think, to adopt the suggestion that there should be a rebuttable presumption that that its purpose was proper under those circumstances. And in the Cordham case, which both parties have cited, the court did grant the 50% member unrestricted access to the books and records of the venture, despite the fact that there were pending dissolution proceedings, despite the fact that the requesting member had already conducted a preliminary evaluation of the books and records of the joint venture, which is something that THQ has emphasized to great extent, the 118,000 pages, which I will get to. And also, despite the fact fact that there was no imminent opportunity to sell the shares that were held by the 50% member. Those facts apply with equal force here. Jax has a significant interest to value in this joint venture, and the fact of the upcoming renewal itself, which is a decision on which Jax has an equal interest, is something that Jax is entitled to equal access to the books and records of this joint venture to determine its performance, to determine whether or not to make the capital expenditures that THQ submits, both parties have to agree upon, and to in order to gauge the future value of that present renewal right. In terms of Jack's interest as a 50% member, the court completely overlooked all of those contractual rights, those co-management rights, and reduced Jack's interest, I submit, improperly, just to its interest in the preferred return. But even if we were to focus solely on Jack's interest in the preferred return, it's undisputed that Jack needs access to the books and records of the joint venture to determine the actual profits in order to determine what the preferred return will be, because the contract establishes that the objective of that preferred return is that it be approximately 49% of the net profits of the joint venture.
I'm sorry, when you say determine what the preferred return will be, you're talking about in 2010?
I'm talking both about in 2010 and, frankly, at the time of the initial request, which, you know, notwithstanding the fact that the arbitration proceedings are over, Jax had the right then to be able to assess the accuracy of the financial information that had been provided by THQ. And in this respect, this again dovetails with the first basis for Jax to find a credible basis for the court to infer mismanagement, and that was the very pervasive and serious inconsistencies and gaps and discrepancies in the financial information that was provided by THQ about the joint venture to Jax. And it's important for the court to understand that.
Well, that was based on the testimony of an expert that the court that was discredited and the court found was discredited. Are you asking us to overturn that finding?
Actually, this de novo review, this court, first of all, needs to assess whether or not the court applied the proper burden. And in fact, the court did not apply the proper burden, which, as we know, based on the Seinfeld case, we quote in the Lampers case, is the lowest possible burden. That is to show that there's a basis to infer potential mismanagement so as to warrant further investigation. This court in the Security First case made it very clear. You don't have to prove mismanagement. All you have to make is a credible showing that there are issues of wrongdoing. And this is what Mr. Anastasi did, Your Honor.
But you know, that's a theory in the abstract. That theory doesn't get you the relief you want unless you can connect it to this company's books through this expert. The expert's testimony was tossed out. What do we do with that?
Well, what we do with that is that, first of all, the what was before the court was an expert report which cataloged a long list of accounting discrepancies and variances and red flags. And what the court did was the court tossed that out, if you will, based on three reasons. And those reasons are not entitled to deference on review. The first is that just looking at the variances that were shown between what THQ created, which are top-line financial summaries and underlining general ledger detail, Mr. Anastasi documented variances for every year from 1999 through 2006. At trial, THQ, on cross-examination, only questioned the variances for one of those 7 years. And with respect to that, and this is the sole basis for the court's conclusion, the THQ offered an hypothesis that some of those discrepancies for 2006 might be explained by the fact, unbeknownst to everybody, that THQ offered it had not produced the entirety of the 2006 data. On cross-examination, Mr. Anastasi conceded that was a possibility. That is the full extent of the basis for throwing out his report. But more importantly, even after the hearing with the full access to the records in the post-trial briefing, it was shown that that hypothesis did not hold water. That in fact, the variances just for 2006 could not be explained away by THQ's late disclosure that it had not provided all of the 2006 information. Why is that? Because the post-trial briefing showed, and it is undisputed, that in fact for the second half of 2006, the general ledger data that THQ produced, in fact, had close to 3,000 entries for the second half of the year. So there.
Let me interrupt you for just a moment. We recall a lot of what you're telling us now because it was set forth in your brief, and you only have a minute and a half left of the time you wanted to reserve. As I indicated earlier, okay. You can continue or you can reserve this minute and a half.
I'll just conclude really briefly on just for a second. Most importantly, THQ never reconciled the data, never reconciled it for any of the years. So this court can review this record right now as it currently stands and assess whether or not JAX has met its minimum burden, the lowest burden, to show a basis for wrongdoing it. And I will reserve the remainder of my minute. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Elder.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Charles Elder from Irell and Manella on behalf of THQ. The Vice Chancellor's judgment should be affirmed for all the reasons stated in our papers. And for the purposes of this hearing, there are about four or five points that we hope the court will take away. First, Vice Chancellor Lamb did not hold, as JAX asserts in its reply on page 7, that it was, quote, denying JAX any access to the books and records of the JV. In fact, the Vice Chancellor simply held that JAX was not entitled to any more information than the tremendous amount of material that THQ had already provided. Indeed, the Vice Chancellor's opinion very carefully documents the substantial amount of material that was produced, as well as the evidence, including the testimony of THQ's Vice President of Finance, demonstrating the credibility and reliability of this financial information.
Well, let me ask you a philosophical question. If you're a 50% member, no matter how you got there, why shouldn't you be entitled to look at the books, just as a matter of course?
Because the cases that I've read, including the courtroom case, suggest that you should have, if you're a 50% member, it's almost presumptive that you should get access to it because the assumption underlying is that you have a 50% residual equity interest that you need to value. And in the Cortoon case, that was exactly the situation. The company was even up for public auction, as indicated in the dissolution papers. Here, this is an LLC that frankly is probably different from any LLC I'm guessing that you all have seen, in the sense that there is no residual equity interest. That is the fact. And Vice Chancellor Lamb recognized that fact and so held specifically in his opinion. And that finding was correct. There is no residual capital equity interest. So there's nothing to value other than the sole financial interest that JAX does have, and that is the preferred return, which is, as Vice Chancellor Lamb correctly described, essentially a royalty payment. So it gets X percent, for this period it's 6%, 6% of net sales off the top. And THQ basically is responsible for all costs of operating the venture. If it's inefficient, that's on THQ.
So your answer to my question seems to be all 50% members in an LLC are not equal. And in order to determine your right of inspection, rather than have the people who form the LLC deal with that in the documents, it's incumbent on the court to look at every LLC in a books and records case and make a determination about whether they're equal or not. Is that correct?
I'm not sure I'm saying quite that. What I'm saying is this particular, the rights of the parties are spelled out in this particular LLC document. And the document,
but not with regard to inspection.
It doesn't say anything about with respect to inspection or audit rights. It does say, it does provide what THQ is supposed to give JAX, and that is sales information. And that's it, sales information and sales forecasts.
That's as a matter of course.
That doesn't matter, of course, right. Because that is what the preferred return, which is Jax's interest, is based upon.
Right, but my question is, when you're not getting what the agreement provides for as a matter of course, there are two ways to deal with your rights of inspection, the statute or the agreement. And you're suggesting that if you haven't addressed it in the agreement, the statute isn't going to help the court with regard to a 50% interest unless you look beyond it to see the nature of the 50% interest. And only when you make a judicial determination with regard to the nature of the 50% interest can you decide what you're entitled to under an inspection request.
Perhaps. I mean, I don't know that I would make a categorical rule like that, but I think the law is that the books and records request must be related to whatever interest is being asserted in connection with an LLC or a company.
Well, hypothetically, if we had two members equal in all respects, what would your position be with respect to inspection rights?
It would be, I think the Courtone case may deal with that, which is if they have, I guess 50%, what does that mean? If they have a 50% equity interest.
Identical in every respect.
Right. Okay,
each 50% for purposes of my hypothetical is identical in every respect. My question is, somebody's got the books and somebody doesn't. If you're the 50% member without the books, do you get to see everything as a matter of course or not, in my hypothetical?
As a matter of course, I would say not. If the agreement doesn't provide that you get to see it as a matter of course, then I think you do look to the statute, and then the question becomes, is there an interest that the 50% LLC owner has is there an interest that needs to be served by seeking these documents, and are the documents being sought reasonably related to that interest?
Well, to follow up on what I think that Justice Holland was asking, if in this particular case the plaintiff had the same identical 50% interest as the other joint venture, then that would not only confer standing to seek a court-ordered inspection, but if assuming that the purpose was to value the interest, that 50% interest, then in all likelihood the books of the joint venture would be open.
Because
all of that would be relevant to evaluation of the equity interest.
I could certainly see a situation in which that would be the case. Yes.
But in this case, the court found that, yes, the plaintiff has a 50% interest in the joint venture, therefore there's no issue about standing to seek inspection. The only question is what the scope of the inspection would be. And what the purpose of the inspection would be, and the bona fides of the purpose have to be evaluated in relation to the real economic interest that 50% interest represents.
Exactly.
And in this case, we're not talking about an open-ended residual equity interest, but rather a narrow contractual right to a preferred return. And that is what textured the reasoning of the court. Is that what happened?
I think that is fair to say. indeed, just to follow up on that first point, when Jax first approached THQ asking for information for purposes of this preferred return negotiation for the period that lasts from mid-2006 through the end of this year, THQ voluntarily gave the information. Now, there was obviously some back and forth, some negotiation over scope, but THQ did provide that information because it was, at that point in time, it was relevant to the arbitration and the negotiations over what the preferred return would be. What Vice Chancellor Lamb held is that that's now done, that the rate at that time, the arbitration had happened, and it was before the arbitrator, as Ms. Greenwalds points out in her opening. That's been fixed, so it's now 6%. So there's nothing more to value. And I'll abandon my outline for just a second and go to the issue of the renewal question. There is no renewal, not yet anyway. The Jacks has not, the parties have not agreed to renew.
But how do you respond to her point that you have to start negotiations 6 months, and before the end of this period?
The agreement does say that you should start before the next subsequent distribution period. However, as your colleague pointed out, it's a little otherworldly where I think the assumption was if there's an understanding that there's going to be a renewal, you should do it first. Now, I would say that that has not happened at any point in this joint venture. The preferred return for the period July 2006 through December 2009, we didn't even start negotiating that until late 2006.
Well, maybe I don't understand otherworldly, and you can help me out. If the agreement says you negotiate 6 months before the end of the term, and the agreement says you decide whether to renew it 60 days before the end, is that right or not?
Well, it doesn't say that you decide. What it says is that the renewal is not automatic. It is an option that must be exercised.
So your colleague is incorrect when she tells us the default position is renewal.
Correct. She is incorrect.
Okay.
And the it is an option that has to be renewed. It has not yet been renewed, as the parties, I think, are in agreement on. Jax did, in the reply brief, they point out they did try to send a renewal notice to WWE without THQ's consent, which gives you a clue as to why we may not want to renew with these folks again. But they tried to send a renewal notice, but as they stay in their opening papers, there hadn't been a renewal. They'd sent that notice by the time they filed their opening papers.
Going back to my question, though.
Sure.
And this concept that the whole notion is just otherworldly.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't the negotiations begin 6 months ahead of time and require some knowledge of the documents so that you could make an informed decision on the question of renewal? Why is that so far out of the realm of being sensible that it's otherworldly, that the negotiations would inform you about whether to renew?
Well, bear in mind, the negotiations that are talked about for the 180 days
yeah.
aren't about the question whether to renew it. It's a question about the financial interest.
Your point is that the people don't get along.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of my question is that to the extent you engage in these negotiations during the 180-day period, it would also give you an indication of whether you want to continue in business with the other 50% person, and renew.
Conceivably, that's correct. I think in this case, on this record, it's fairly clear that that's not what's needed here. I mean, Jax has, for all practical intents and purposes, voted already. They want to continue because they get free money. And THQ has not made its decision yet. The negotiations over the preferred return aren't really going to inform that. Whether Jax gets THQ's additional information from THQ isn't really going to inform that. So the question then becomes, what is the purpose for the information for that basis? And I think it just makes no sense, given that it really is speculative.
But why is it in the agreement? When we do statutory construction or construing contracts, we always say things like words have a purpose, you have to give them their meaning. And I'm not sure what your answer is, that this is a meaningless provision that we can ignore under the facts, or why is this provision for the 180 days so insignificant? And if it is insignificant, why is it in the agreement?
Well, I would say it's not insignificant in the sense that 180-day period doesn't apply only to renewal. When the contract was originally entered back in 1999, the contemplation was that there would be three distribution periods plus maybe a renewal period. And so for the first distribution period, the preferred return was set at 10%. And so the agreement contemplated that for the next distribution period, which was guaranteed, that was automatic, then 180 days before that, you were supposed to negotiate. Same thing for the third renewal period, distribution period. So it's not meaningless in the context of those distribution periods. And it's very well possible, I think the parties, the people who drafted this contract, I don't know that they're even around at the companies anymore, but I think there's an assumption that at the time, 1999, the assumption was that the parties would probably agree on renewal. And assuming that there's agreement on renewal, you should try to negotiate, at least start your negotiations for the preferred return, what the preferred return is going to be at that time. And so in that context, it makes some sense. Here, there is a very real question whether there's going to be a renewal. There's sort of two questions. One is, can the parties even agree on whether to renew? And then there's a second question, which is whether would that renewal still be valid in light of the fact that the WWE has essentially said we're not going to recognize it because you're in default.
As you know, your opponent cites the Holtzman's case for the proposition that my rights are determined now, not based on what might happen in the future.
I agree. And as of the status quo right now, there has been no renewal. And so when you apply Holtzman to the facts of this case, and I think this is where Vice Chancellor Lamb got it exactly right. I mean, this was all in the briefs that were submitted to him as well as to this court, that whether there's going to be a renewal and whether that renewal is going to be valid is a question for another day. And candidly, though it's not in the record, it's a question for at least two or three other proceedings between JAX and THQ. This court doesn't need to decide whether the renewal is automatic or whether it's valid.
When is the last date for making the renewal decision?
I want to say November 1st. For sending the notice is November 1st, I believe. It's 60 days prior to January 1st. So I may be a day off, but beginning of November.
You're saying there's no need for these negotiations now, even though the contract contemplates them, because on November 1st, we may decide not to renew. So my question is, what was the logic in writing the agreement to have the negotiations precede the date to give notice on renewal?
Again, that language of the 180 days was drafted not specifically with respect to the renewal. It had to do with every distribution period, including the ones that were, in fact, automatic. And, I don't want to testify about what was in people's heads at the time, but there was probably an assumption that that it was likely the parties would renew. So to us, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense for JAX to get additional information. And by the way, there's no finding in the record that the information JAX already has isn't good enough for the purpose of determining the preferred return going forward. And I'll talk about that for a second. But even assuming they would be entitled to additional information, we're sort of putting the cart before the horse to go through this exercise of producing, essentially what they've asked for is the entire general ledger of THQ, only to then a month and a half later, get to a point where, we decide we don't want to renew.
Let me approach it from a different perspective then. Are you suggesting that on November 1, assuming against all probabilities, apparently, everybody renews? At that point, are you just going to voluntarily hand over all these books and records? Because after all, then you will be in a posture where the next return rate has to be determined, and the request will be valid.
If the parties were to agree on a renewal and the renewal were to be determined valid, then yes, the parties would have to have a negotiation over what the preferred return would be, and that may or may not entail giving them more information than what we've already given, which transitions me to my next point, which is we've given JAX a tremendous amount of financial information, including not just information up to 2006, but more recent 2009 information. And as the court has recognized, Vice Chancellor Lamb took a look at what the expert in that case did. And it wasn't just a question of picking out one little minor detail. This was the expert's headlining point. He said the information that we got in the profit and loss statements and in the income statements, they don't match up to the general ledger. Now, they talk about hundreds, Ms. Reynolds mentioned that there are hundreds of instances of these supposed variances. Mr. Anastasi, the expert, didn't talk about hundreds of variances. He mentioned that ipse dixit, and he gave two or three examples, all of which were from 2006, and all of which were debunked at trial. And furthermore, he then lied, because we asked, were you aware that you were comparing 6-month data to 12-month data? And he said yes. And just in case you want to look that up in the record, that's at A166 of the record. So, which means either, I think, first of all, I think he was lying then, because I think he just admitted he made a goof. But if I'll take him at his word that he was aware, then that meant he submitted a deliberately misleading expert report, because he didn't say anything about that in his testimony or in his report. And there were a number of other things which we talked about in our papers which were wrong with the expert report. And I think that under the holdings of the Security First case, the Thomas and Betts case, and the Levitt case, Vice Chancellor Lamb, looking at this guy, seeing him fumble with his papers, seeing the long pauses, his credibility determination that this guy was not credible, and thus there was no basis at all to question the financial information already provided by THQ, is entitled to substantial deference. Thank you.
Your Honor, just a few quick things on the renewal. It is automatic by definition, quote unquote, under the video game license. That's at A497, and under the joint venture agreement at A487. It's clear it's the default position. We've laid that out in our brief. But the clouds that THQ identifies for renewal are just as applicable now, frankly, as they were in 2006 before the prior period. One is WW's litigation. That was filed in 2004, seeking to void the whole license. It's been dismissed by every court in which that has been litigated, federal court, Second Circuit affirmed, and in state court. And the second cloud is that THQ may choose not to abide by the joint venture agreement. That was equally present then. But that was no reason for the parties not to go forward and with their contractual obligations to negotiate the preferred return. One last thing on the information that Anastasi presented. It is very important that THQ's own financial witness, when asked on the stand whether he could disagree with Anastasi's conclusion that the general ledger did not tie into the top line summaries that THQ created, said he could not say whether or not that was true or not. That's at A287. That is all important because Jax months before told THQ that they didn't tie in. That's at A920. Chancellor Land's decision didn't turn on demeanor. It turned on an analysis of that evidence, and it disregarded the vast majority, and it's not entitled to deference for that reason. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement. We'll take a short recess.
Bye.